Last time we, looking at religious life, new religious lifestyles in America, we had a look at some pretty, you know, practical, down-to-earth, what I suppose some people would call realistic features of what the new parish might be in the future. And I deliberately wanted to have not necessarily the opposite, but a strong contrast today, because what else is, another major trend, I think, that's growing in the United States, in our day, it started a little while ago, and I think it'll continue to grow, is something which seems far removed from what we were talking about yesterday, but which I think in a certain sense is related, and that's what I call mysticism, and I'll define that in a little while. And I would like to simply talk for a few minutes about some of the major trends, I think, that are found in the new religious lifestyle, which is related to mysticism, and really what it means, and then I'd be, you know, very happy to have as much discussion as we have time for. And obviously, when I start talking about mysticism, a lot of people are, I think, somewhat, you know, at least curious, because mysticism doesn't really sort of belong to the American Christian tradition. Mysticism really comes out of the East, out of Asia, out of things that we like to call Zen or Buddha or whatever it is. And in America, if I were to ask you, for instance, for a list of qualities about what makes Americans different from people, let's say, in other parts of the world, not only religiously, but everyway, I think in America you'd have to say we are, our society is characterized by hard work, by thrift, practicality, getting the job done, being realistic, being practical, being down to earth. And all of these things seem to be a long, long way, light years really, removed from this thing we call mysticism. And yet I think that mysticism, in the sense that I want to talk about it, is a growing trend in the United States, and isn't necessarily the opposite of what we were talking about yesterday, nor necessarily the opposite of this realistic, practical, down-to-earth kind of attitude that I've talked about before. But before we go any further, I think I should try to define, at least put out a working definition of what I mean by mysticism, because some people will think I'm talking about, you know, peyote and induced hallucinations or something, and I really don't have that in mind. Aldous Huxley, I guess, found that to be his entrance into the great cosmic whatever out there somewhere. But I'm not talking about drug-induced phenomena. I'm not talking about astrological phenomena. I'm not talking about the occult. These are things which I would simply put in the world of the supernatural, not the supernatural of superstition. That's what I'm trying to say, not supernatural, but of superstition. But rather, I think the mystical experience would include, I think, really two elements to it that I use for a working definition, and then we'll go ahead. First of all, I think in a mystical experience, there's a feeling of deep peace. That is, that conditions, no matter how difficult they seem now, the conditions will work out for good. That life and nature and people really are at one, at peace with one another. And furthermore, the mystical experience not only is a sense of being at one with another, that there is kind of a unity to everything that happens, but it's what Abraham Maslow calls a peak experience. One in which it all comes together within a short period of time. It isn't something which is an ongoing experience, but it is something, in a sense, like a conversion experience, in that, although I don't want to get quite that, you know, I suppose you could say theological in defining a mystical experience, because I don't think it has to be essentially a theological one. But there is a peak experience which people who have had the mystical experience know that something's happened to them, and they can define it, that it happened at a given time. They aren't necessarily, as I'll talk about later, aware of the actual, you know, minutes and seconds and hours that are involved in an experience, but that it was a specific time in their lives in which this happened. All right. The best way, really, to explain what I'm trying to get at is to read a couple of descriptions by people who have had mystical experiences, those within the Christian tradition, because there are, goodness knows, plenty, of course, otherwise. And some of you know the great French philosopher Blaise Pascal, and Pascal talked about his mystical experience this way. From about 10:30 in the evening to about half an hour after midnight, fire, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, not the God of philosophers and scholars, absolute certainty, beyond reason, joy, peace, forgetfulness of the world and everything but God. The world has not known me, but I have known me. Joy, joy, tears of joy. And I've got more, but I think we're a little bit behind, so I'll let it go at that. We know, of course, that there has been, really, since the time of the apostles, a deep mystical tradition within Christianity. We think, for instance, that Jesus had two what we would call mystical experiences, certainly at the time of the temptation was one, and also at the time of the transfiguration. If anybody can sort of explain to me what happened, you know, in sort of rationalist cause and effect terms, what happened at the transfiguration, you know, I'd like to hear. I haven't heard that sermon yet, and I don't think I probably ever will hear that sermon. Paul, we know, had a mystical experience in which he talks about up into the third heaven. This is in 1 Corinthians 12. chapter 2 in which Paul talks about this sort of thing, and all the way through. The Ron, for instance, was quoting from Bernard Christensen's book. And Professor, well, he used to be president of Augsburg College, has produced a marvelous little book, The Inward Pilgrimage, in which he has sort of a history and a study of the great classics and Christian mystical thought and experience throughout our history. What they really sort of add up to is a combination of certain themes, I suppose you could say, or certain reactions that we all know, sort of a combination of joy, light, peace, warmth, unity, certainty, confidence, and all oftentimes rebirth. Now, one question, of course, that comes up right away with mysticism is, are these purely human, you know, kinds of experiences? Can we look at mystical experiences and find the explanation for them in our psyche, in our psychological apparatus? Are they, as some people say, the result of some sort of mental illness or some sort of neurosis, some sort of mental disturbance? Some people argue that mystical experience is a form of regression, an escape from reality. That is, since the mystic can't cope with the real world, he flees to the world of what the critics call make-believe. Or other people think, and there's, I think, something to this, that sometimes mystical experience are merely fads, especially among the young people who are already bored with life as they know it by the age of 19 or 20 and are looking for the latest, you know, kick to come along. And oftentimes this is true also, don't worry, I'm not going to just pick on the young people. Oftentimes in middle age, when people need, what you call a rejuvenation at a certain time, and I'll show some statistics later, where the best evidence we have shows that the chief age group which gets involved in mystical experience, would you believe, are Protestant males between 40 and 50. And that's me, you know, among others, and which would say that it's something more than a fad or something trying to keep up with the other things at school. Now, obviously, it's not within my capacity to pass final judgment on whether or not people who have mystical experiences are indeed suffering from some sort of neurosis, but the best evidence we have so far is that they're not, that people who have had mystical experiences which they can define and which they can recognize as such are of reasonably good health and are not trying to escape or flee from the world or try to get into some never land, but actually seem to have a rather positive, healthy, constructive attitude towards the world and the problems and the difficulties in that. Now, what I want to try to get at then is, why should mysticism, this kind of mystical experience, have such a resurgence in our day and age? And what does this resurgence tell us about us right at this particular time? Because it's one thing to talk about mystical experiences, but since I'm a historian, I like to try to find out why they happened when they did. This is one thing I always mention the first day of class, is not only what happened, but why it happened, and not only why it happened, but why did it happen at that time in history? And my students threaten to put on my tombstone, they're going to put on, you know, why did it happen when it did? Because they've heard it so often that they are going to take up a collection and be sure that it gets there. And also my children are going to, I'm compulsive about coming early, and they're going to take up a collection, and they're going to put on their, it's going to be a big one, they're going to put on their, he came a little early, is another one. The funniest I ever saw, though, was for historians on tombstones, a cartoon at the graduate school at Madison, where I was, and they had all the information, you know, born and all these things, and then at the end they had a little footnote, you know, and then they had, you know, only in academic world could you have footnotes on your tombstone, you know, really, and it's a certain breed, I'm glad they're small in number. With this. Now, in order to understand why mystical experience has caught on, I think, so well in America, in many circles, and another thing that's important here, and I'll probably bring it up again, it is that the whole mystic tradition is catching on in circles which usually weren't open to this sort of thing. Well-educated, reasonably well-to-do people who previously, you know, 20, 30 years ago wouldn't have been seen, you know, or caught dead in one of these kinds of experiences or kinds of situations. And it's caught on in respectability, and that tells us something certainly about America and about some of the new religious lifestyles in which we're involved now. And I want to draw here on why it happened when it did from the writings of a sociologist of religion at Berkeley, Robert Bella. And Bella has, I think, a very good diagnosis of why, in, you know, sort of broad general terms, why Americans have turned to mysticism, not necessarily as a retreat or an escape, but simply as a response to some of the forces and the new ideas which are at work in America. And these are quite familiar, so I'll just sketch them very briefly, and then we can get into the sort of the heart of and definition of mysticism itself. He argues that what has happened, especially starting in the 1960s and continuing into the 1970s, is that two great ideas helped Americans understand their place, their mission, their meaning, and their purpose in life have really suffered tremendous erosion or decline in popularity. Two specific ideas, and the first would be the sense, or the religious sense of mission in America. mission. Americans, right from the very beginning, have always thought of themselves as something special, something unique in the world in which they were to be, as William Bradford said to the Pilgrims, you remember, as early as 1630, a city set upon a hill for all the world to see. And therefore, since we were to be the new Garden of Eden, the new land of plenty, the new place where the human race and Christianity really, in a sense, could start over again, then America was something unique and special. God had made a covenant with us. And all the biblical themes here, of course, are so familiar with us. Covenant, Exodus, promised land, and then the pilgrimage, you know, eventually coming to the kingdom. The whole cycle here of biblical metaphors that we're so familiar with. Americans have seen themselves in these terms, not necessarily in strictly biblical terms, but in secular terms. Certainly some of the biblical motifs about pilgrimage, Exodus, and kingdom have characterized much of America. And therefore, we have had really a sense of assurance and security that since, you know, America succeeded so well, since we were able to, you know, conquer the environment and build the great industrial plants and all the rest that we did, that this must mean that God is approving of what we've done. Otherwise, why should so many people, you know, immigrants coming across and everything, why should so many Americans have, you know, prospered so much unless it had been God's will? And therefore, since it was really a sort of a test, and since we were so many people did do well, my father-in-law, for instance, came over from Czechoslovakia with less than a second-grade education and wound up to be a very stable, prosperous, and involved kind of farmer and businessman in Racine, Wisconsin. And he would give me, I don't know how many times I heard that sermon, you know, from him, but about the opera. I was sitting there knocking America, and he would, you know, come back with what had happened to him, because he grew up in a country where when the landlord came by, they would all have to take off their hat and bow, which was not really what my father-in-law really, you know, liked doing. So he, you know, so he was very caught up in this idea of the success and the proof sort of the American dream. And for many people, the American dream really did come true. The idea of with hard work, thrift, industry, and all the rest, you were bound to succeed. And therefore, the American sense of mission, of having God, you know, supporting America, was very strong for a large number of Americans. And this was supported by a second idea, besides the idea of religious sense of mission. Because, you know, we have this idea, as I say, we're covenant in people. I always use the contrast. People down in El Salvador don't have this idea, you know, that they have a special mission in life. And then I got a big sign the next day. I said this in class once, and I got a big sign the next day. Unfair to El Salvadorians, you know. I'm picking on them, but I just used it. You know, you could use British Honduras or whatever. But people in those countries don't have this kind of sense of mission, but obviously in America we do. The second idea, which comes right out of the first one, is the idea of what Bella calls utilitarian individualism. That is the idea that the way in which you get ahead in America is this thing, and I talked about a little bit briefly before, a very, very real concern with what is real, what is practical, what pays, what, you know, the demands of the marketplace. If technology can build something, and if we have the means to construct something, then we should construct something. If, for instance, a long time, you know, about 10, 15 years ago with a freeway thing, since we could build freeways, then since they were efficient and added to speed and ease of transportation and all the rest of the things, then we should build them. And it's remarkable that just in the last 4 or 5 years, there's been this, you know, backlash against freeways. Those of us in Minneapolis know the reaction against the freeways that are starting there. And they're never going to get this Hiawatha Avenue thing built. I'm convinced that they're trying to get something from Fort Snelling to downtown built along Hiawatha Avenue, if you know that. And, you know, 10 years ago it would have gone through. They could have just rammed it through, but now I don't think, you know, it's not just because we've got Charlie for mayor, although that may be helpful. I don't know, the point was that for a long time we had the idea that if reason, if rationality, if technology could do something, then we should do something. And we were very sympathetic towards the results, towards the products that technology could create for us. And the premium was always on efficiency, on cutting costs, on a clearly structured hierarchy in which people were fitted to certain jobs. And you've all worked, I'm sure, in organizations where you have your sort of your table of operations in which everybody fits in, and you have your flow charts, and he reports to her and she reports to him, and, you know, it's all very neat, structured, and you sort of join in rather than having the company or the business being bent to or suited to people. It's the other way around. And since so many Americans seem to prosper from this idea of utilitarian individualism, then obviously it must be the right thing. And furthermore, there was the old idea, which really goes back to the 18th century, that, you know, within reason, obviously, so long as people pursued their own individual interests, that the best interests of society would be served, rather than having, you know, the government dominate in some form of socialism or whatever it might be. The best way in which the interests of society could be served would be to let each individual work out his own destiny as best he could. And for a long time, this became the American dream, the idea of hard work, thrift, get a good education, get out there in the world and do your best. That everybody had sort of an equal chance in life. Everybody started at the same starting line. And if you succeeded in life, it is because you deserved it, you earned it. And if you failed in life, it is because, you know, you yourself were inadequate. If you didn't make it, if you didn't prosper by or achieve it by your, you know, comparison to your neighbor, it was your fault. It wasn't the neighbor's fault altogether. All right. Now, what happens is that these two ideas, the idea of religious idea of mission and the idea of utilitarian individualism, simply collapse, really, in our day. Because for a long time, we had identified the idea of mission with foreign policy and with our involvement in wars. And Woodrow Wilson, who was himself a PK, you remember his father was a Southern Presbyterian minister, identified the American mission in World War I as God's will. Make the world safe for democracy, a war to end all war, peace without victory, and so on, and saw this specifically as a religious mission in America. He had started, interestingly enough, with Wilson, he had started off as president as a pacifist himself, but had become converted to the necessity for war because he saw the American idea. FDR had the same thing. You remember the Four Freedoms were considered to be a sacred trust which were given to Americans to preserve. And suddenly with the war, which I don't have to talk about anymore, that we've just been through, all this simply no longer makes any sense. So there's no longer the sense of assurance of Americans in this religious sense of mission, which I think had furnished a sense of identity for a long time. The same thing is true with economic growth. For a long time, economic growth was simply accepted uncritically, and the gross national product was supposed to go up about 5% a year, and as long as it did, as long as the stock market kept going up, all was well in the world. Now suddenly, all our hopes, really, and confidence and trust in technology and inventions are backfiring because we have the very real problem, obviously, of conservation of natural resources, of pollution, all these things which are so familiar, and we're now talking about cutting back on growth. We're talking about some way in which economic growth is not necessarily automatically, a positive good in our life. So with the decline or collapse, really, of these two ideas, what I think has happened is that sort of a vacuum has set in for lots of people, even though they might not sit down and say, well, I used to believe yesterday in the religious sense of mission, I don't today. You know, it's obviously not that simple, but people are looking for other kinds of insights. That's what I'm trying to say, other kinds of sources of wisdom, of truth, if you like, of meaning and direction and purpose. And they can't find it in the older sense that I've suggested here. They can't really sort of, in a sense, commit themselves, to America anymore because it'll take some more of that healing, the healing of that breach has taken place. And there isn't the old confidence that by getting into the rat race, working for a corporation or for academia or whatever it might be, is automatically going to bring the good things in life. So a kind of a vacuum set in. Now, when mysticism first came in, the question becomes, well, why didn't the churches, do more about it? Why does this concern for mysticism and the mystical insight, I suppose you could say, or the mystical perspective, seem to exist sort of alongside or sometimes even outside the churches themselves? For the most part, the churches really weren't ready for it. I'm not criticizing it, it's simply a fact. The churches really weren't ready to cope with what we call the new spirituality. Because the new spirituality was demanding I'll talk about Andrew Greeley here in a minute, what Greeley calls for immediate, powerful, and deep religious experience. That is to say that rather than have sort of a future-oriented sense of fulfillment, that the kingdom will come sometime, and that our religious lives and our great religious insights will be fulfilled at a later time in history, now the mystics are saying that they want their kingdom here and now, that they want fulfillment, a deep personal experience in which everything fits together in place right at this particular moment. And they're not willing to defer this any longer, such as the old Catholic or Protestant idea, taught them to do, that eventually, I'm but a pilgrim here, heaven is my home kind of mentality. And that I don't hear that at funerals anymore, but that's one sign of progress, I think, in America. But anyway, the churches weren't ready for this because the churches taught that a kind of a deep religious fulfilling experience would come in the hereafter. And hence, we're not ready for this kind of deep religious experience. Furthermore, a lot of people in the churches were afraid of open, unabashed, what we call deep religious experience or experiential kind of knowledge. Churches are institutions like our schools or government or anything else which really emphasize sort of a clear, verbal, rational, step-by-step explanation of what's happening to us. We like to know what's happening to us, and when we have the kind of freewheeling, wide open emphasis that you have in or insight that you have in mysticism, it frightens people, because how can you tell if anything, quote, is true or untrue in mysticism? If it's all out there somewhere, then you're saying that all experience is true and that there aren't any sort of real standards, and a lot of institutions, including churches, aren't really ready for this. Now, a second feature that I think helps increase the mystical experience in America, making it one of our new religious lifestyles, is that so many more people can know so much more about it than ever was the case before. It's become a media event. And I started collecting articles on this, and almost all religious journals, popular journals, scholarly journals, TV, newspapers, and all the rest have articles on mysticism in one way or another. But the real source of new information on it is in the bookstores. I'm just give you a personal reaction. One of my favorite pastimes is to stand in one of the biggest volume bookstores in Minneapolis. It's B. Dalton. There's one downtown and one in Southdale, and watch where the people go. Where is the traffic? And the traffic is invariably towards mysticism and towards self-help. And sometimes the two really aren't that far apart. All these, you know, books about TA, you know, I'm okay, you're okay, and how to be your own best friend, and winning through intimidation. This whole new emphasis that has come up about how to get control of your life and improve it is a real source of information, and many, many more people know more about mysticism than ever knew about before, and it's become much more popularized. The ideas before were sort of in the hands of some American scholars like Alan Watson or S. who understood Asia or understood the mystical tradition, or they were, many of our great religious classics were couched in language of medieval Europe. Thomas A. Kempis, for instance, which is a very heavy sort of thing. Or John Bunyan, which is one of the great classics, of course, Pilgrim's Progress. It is in sort of a 17th century language, which sort of turns a lot of people off. But now popularizers have been able to put this into rather clear, precise kinds of language, and I think this has caught on terrifically. All right. So when people who become, you know, disenchanted with some of the older ideas which had been to which they've been loyal for a long time, like the religious sense of mission or individualism, are in this vacuum, they look to the churches. The churches really aren't doing much. The schools aren't doing much. And what happens is that with the new popularization, people get caught up with the idea that perhaps truth, perhaps wisdom is the better word here, perhaps the unity of all being, to use a famous mystical expression here, is really something beyond and above what we thought it was. And since it's sort of out there somewhere, then... How do I say this? I lost my train of thought here. When it's out there somewhere, then we have to look somewhere else than where we've been taught to look for insight and for understanding. And they're attracted to what seems to be a kind of a serene, safe world in which people keep thinking, you know, all things come together on this. I think really what we're seeing here with mysticism, I don't say this critically, is a rejection of the idea that careful, cold, you know, rationalism or reason is the only way to notch. People aren't afraid or aren't as afraid anymore of trusting in deep experiential kind of information or insight. The reason simply, you know, seems inadequate. Look at where reason has led us to our world today. Reason has, they would say, led to technology, and what has technology done, you know, to our environment and this sort of thing. And therefore, there is a kind of a fear or a rejection, really, of old calculating reason and a kind of openness to new kinds of evidence, which really hadn't been the case before. Now, let me sort of summarize this briefly by pointing to a study which Father Andrew Greeley of the National Center for Opinion Research at the University of Chicago made in 1975. And I think this is a fascinating kind of study. It isn't, you know, totally conclusive, but it's the best thing we have on this. In 1975, Greeley and Associates interviewed 1,500 adult Americans, a broad cross-section, came up on this whole question of are we a nation of mystics? And he asked several different questions, and I have all the questions here, but just a couple of the questions that he asked here. He asked this one question: have you ever had the feeling of being very close to a powerful spiritual force that seemed to lift you out of yourself? 40% said yes, which I think is a very high, you know, high figure. 40% said yes of this. 300 of that 40% said it had happened several times, and 75 out of that 40% said it had happened often, which is a kind of information. Now, what kind of a social profile do you have for the people who are mystics? And this goes right back to this idea: are misfits, you know, neurotics? Are they escapists? Are they faddists or whatever? And this is the information that Greeley has come up with. And I've said a little bit about this before. People in their 40s and 50s are somewhat more likely to report mystical experiences than those in their 60s or 70s or those who are teenagers. Protestants are more likely to report these kinds of experiences than are Jews, and there are more Jews than Catholics who report mystical experiences. Fundamentalists are far less frequently likely to report these experiences, while high church Christians are. That is, Episcopalians, Presbyterians, Lutherans, and Catholics are far more prone to report having mystical experiences than are fundamentalists. Beyond that, the very heavy proportion of people in mysticism are people who are male, who are college educated, who are above $10,000 a year in income. Now, I only mention the income thing because that indicates that the people are not fleeing away from the problems of the world because they are poor or because they haven't had a sense of reward by what, you know, society has to offer them. In fact, from what Greeley says here, that there is very little, if any, privation or poverty whatsoever among those people who report mystical experiences. Furthermore, the mystics have happy and positive recollections of their childhood. It isn't, you know, the old Freudian idea that you must have hated your father or something, or improper toilet training or something, you know, that went along with this, and therefore you're some sort of neurotic. Really, the mystics that Greeley interviewed said that they almost all had good relations with their parents and with their siblings. They had good religious education, and most of them in their adult lives have stayed with a major denomination. They attend church regularly, but they don't feel that it's absolutely necessary to stay within one denomination. They want to stay within the Christian tradition, but they don't necessarily feel that they have to stay Episcopalians or Lutherans or Catholics, whatever the case might be. Furthermore, most of them have a very strong confidence that there will be life after death. And it struck me, this profile sounds like an audience at Fulton, really is what it sounds like in terms of education and attitudes towards religion and so on. In other words, Greeley says most mystics whom he interviewed enjoyed what he would call good mental health. Now, what kind of conclusions does he draw from this? This will just wind it up here rather quickly. He says this: the experience of the mystery itself was what he calls cognitive. That is, it wasn't a vision, so to speak, or it wasn't a person coming down and giving information, but it was, quote, the way things really are, or really knowing something fully. And that sense of knowing something fully creates a sense of joy, peace, light, and warmth. It is an unshakable conviction, even if it can't be put into precise language. As one person said, it was like a rose blooming in the snow, and my life has never been the same since. I think it's a nice kind of metaphor to use. Secondly, interestingly enough here, for many of us in here, none of the people who had this religious, this mystical experience talked about it to anybody close to them, to their spouses, to their friends, to their family, to their clergymen. Those asked about the clergy said that if they had told their clergy or their pastor that they had a mystical experience, the clergyman probably would have recommended that they see a psychiatrist, which, you know, this may or may not be true, but it's a good comment. Usually the mystical experience comes without any specific, you know, trigger cause, such as a deep personal crisis, but there's no kind of firm pattern on this. It doesn't take any instant sort of sense of crisis to trigger a mystic experience. For most of the people whom Greeley interviewed, the experience was very intense. It was direct and vivid. For a few people, it was quite quiet and subdued, but in most cases, it was quite direct. One person said this: I stood on the pier looking at the stars, and everything was so peaceful, it seemed like I was in eternity and that it would never end. On this. Now, as I suggest, here's one I've already mentioned here about their determination to stay with organized religion, but not necessarily being totally loyal to any one kind of time denomination. The next general conclusion that he draws was an insight really into this sort of loss of time perspective. For some people, time stood still. For some people, hours seemed like seconds or a few moments like hours. During the time that the experience took place, there was a unity and convergence of all things, and that time simply, the passage or the awareness of time was simply not an issue. One man, for instance, walked down a pier at sunset, and his next memory was that it was sunrise. So the next time he sort of came back to the world as he understood it, was sunrise. He simply was unaware of the passage of time at all the case. In every case, really, the mystical experience was benign and was healthy. Some people felt a sense of finality, of death, of entering another realm, but in no cases was this sense of entering another realm really one that was what we would call threatening. It wasn't a matter of having a bad dream, in other words, in which you're, what should I say, falling off a mountain or you know, just involved in an automobile crash or something else like this. It wasn't, I know I had a very, Well, it turned out to be nobody was hurt, but I had a very serious automobile accident on the freeway, and it took about 2 weeks before I could kick that, you know, get rid of that, sort of reliving that experience over and over again. And I don't know what I was trying to do, punish myself because I wasn't driving carefully or what. I don't know. I should have Irv around to tell me what, you know, what I was doing there. But it isn't that kind of experience at all, because I always, in that case, I experience real fright because I relived that experience over and over. And in the cases here, and I sort of felt that maybe this was it. And really sampling simply wasn't the case. I had a very serious automobile accident on the freeway, and it took about 2 weeks before I could kick that, you know, get rid of that, sort of reliving that experience over and over again. And I don't know what I was trying to do, punish myself because I wasn't driving carefully or what. I don't know. I should have Irv around to tell me what, you know, what I was doing there. But it isn't that kind of experience at all, because I always, in that case, I experience real fright because I relived that experience over and over. And in the cases here, and I sort of felt that maybe this was it. And in Greeley sampling, this simply wasn't the case. Now, without using religious language here, how does Greeley sort of sum up mysticism? He said, "We think these are episodes of intense and immediate cognition in which the total personality of a person is absorbed in an intimate, though transient, relation with the basic forces, cycles, and mechanisms at work in this universe, and with his own psychosomatic composition, that is, his body chemistry." The important thing is that for the people who have had the experience, that everything comes together at one time, and they simply have a picture of all things belonging in place, in a meaningful pattern. And why this happens to some people and not to others is something, you know, that we simply don't know yet. But I think I'll let it go at that and simply suggest that I think in our day there is going to be an increasing interest and involvement in this kind of insight and study, and that it's nothing really, from my standpoint, to be afraid of or frightened by, but obviously it can lapse off into the occult, it can lapse off into the astrological and into pure superstition. But for the time being, we seem to live in a world in which the old ground rules of reason and rationality are pretty well, under serious scrutiny. You know, what do you think?
Do you think that structured or organized church should be more receptive to this type of thought and to make it more part of its own diet?
I think it can introduce people to the great Christian, you know, devotional classics. And Christensen tries to do this in a brief sense. This is one recent book that I happen to review it, and that's one reason I'm aware of it. But there has been, I don't know what, out of ignorance or whatever, a decline of study of the great devotional classics. And I think, along with Bible study, which we were talking about yesterday, and in fact this could be introduced into Bible study, more direct, you know, concern with this. Some court colleges give courses in the great devotional classics. I don't know, Norm, we have a course in the great classics at St. Olaf. I don't know if, you know, Bernard of Clairvaux and Thomas a Kempis and everything, and it's very popular. And if it's well taught, it can be, a real source, I think, of... Do any of you have, you know, experiences with this, you know, in your congregations or colleges or whatever? It'd be interesting to find out if churches are doing this. I know it's one more thing for pastors to do. I know, it's always easy to, you know, tell pastors what to do.
Let someone else do it.
Yeah, let someone else do it, right. But I think...
Well, we do teach a class in our adult education program.
There would be a good place.
On mysticism.
And the differences between the different kinds, like the occult and so on, yeah. Because a lot of people are really confused about this, and I'm afraid myself personally. I'm afraid of astrology. I really am afraid of astrology because it's you know, sort of down to earth and practical. And once in a while, it's true. I mean, I sneak it. You know, at the end of the day, I sneak a look at Gene Dixon, and by golly, you know, that's exactly what happened last Saturday. It said relax and go out on a trip with your friends. And remember, Evelyn, that's exactly what the four of us did last Saturday. Relax. I was going to stay around the village and study and do some research, and Evelyn and a couple others said, let's go out for a hike, and by golly, I went out on a hike, and that's what Jeannie said was going to happen that day. I don't know, but no, really, that's so easy, and a lot of people get hooked on it. I always see people in airports studying astrological books, yeah, Evelyn? No, I excluded that, right. Yeah, but this would have to be with, you know, what kids call straight. Isn't that what they call being straight? that you're, you know, there's no...
But, I mean, you know, is there, one of the questions I have, yeah, for the science journals, you know, is there some chemical thing that, you know,
yes,
yeah,
there, you know, that, like so many other things, like with you know, alcoholism and other states of mind that create, you know, states of really, in a sense, dependency here. They're, you know, they're working more on this, and there are even those who think now, for instance, that crime is chemically induced. There are some people who feel that this is not just a matter of social conditioning. And it's not just a matter of original sin either, but that it can actually be chemically induced some way. Yeah. Fine. If there's a bind hike. Yeah, this will be on tape, sure. If, well, today we will. I don't know. It's coffee break right now. If anybody wants to go. No, there's not tomorrow. But if we could keep talking about it, you know, at a different time if people wanted to. Fine.
What are some of the great books
in classics? Well, get the book from Ron. It's Ron Christensen. He was president at Augsburg for such a long time. The Inward Pilgrimage. I think, in fact, we have it at the bookstore, if I'm not mistaken. I always like
the
Is it in the library? Good. I'd like to put in a plug for Augsburg Publishing House. Eh? Good friends up there, Ron Klug and Roland Seabolt and so on. But Thomas, my favorite, the one I use, is Thomas A Kempis, the Imitation of Christ. I just think that's one of the great things that I find new things in there every time I go back to it. John Bunyan, you can, well, there's so many. Luther has many devotional things that some people oftentimes overlook. And in a way, what Lois Erickson is doing is somewhat related to this. There's simply more interest in this form of more reflective rather than critical understanding, you know, of how should I say, it's understanding of a transcendent realm. And I'm very interested that she's doing these things here. She has one on Christian meditation at 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Luther's
quiet times, right. And I think that's a sign. I think it's a tricky thing because it can get so easily off into the bizarre. But on the other hand, I think there's a rich tradition here which the Christian should claim and should pursue. But I would say that take a look at there and see what happens.
You think this fits a large congregation, medium size, or a house church
better? I don't think that is, you know, too big an issue, because I think in one sense a large congregation has the advantage of having a wide variety of people and you have different kinds of interests. But on the other hand, you can never tell where somebody might pop up with an interest on this in this. And if it's well done, I think on a small congregation it could be the basis for something which you could introduce, but which you wouldn't have to keep using every year. I mean, you could start off people reading the great classics and see what happens. And it would, I think the best thing that could happen to a study group on the classics would be for it not to be organized after about the first year, that it would just be on a personal basis, that people would continue doing this themselves. They might need the encouragement and direction on where to go. But from that point on, it would sort of self-destruct, I suppose.
Well, could a small discussion group of 8 to 15 mm-hmm. people adapt this type of a...
Yeah, I think, I wouldn't want, 8 would sound the maximum, because it would be a matter of what we call today not consciousness raising, but of sharing. And there's only so much time in any group for sharing. And I think the smaller the group, the really, in a sense, the greater ease there is for sharing.
Study and discussion.
Right, for study and discussion.
And personal.
And personal, exchange. I think more and more people want that. Certainly, this is true with groups, I think, within the church and the kinds of paragroup things, too, because I haven't even talked about one source of this, is that the whole encounter group, world, T groups, the whole human potential movement is an indication that people want something more than, they want close, direct, immediate, experiential kind of knowledge. Yeah.
I was just wondering if this falls in the same category. I don't know if you've heard of Catherine Kuhlman from California.
Yeah.
She was very much of a spiritual healer.
Right.
She had a lot of TV exposure.
Yeah.
And for myself, I found her, you know, maybe over dramatic, and I was skeptical. But she always claimed that all of her healing powers were through Jesus Christ, but she didn't have any powers.
Mm-hmm.
She had a lot of followers.
Yeah, that healing is a sort of a subdivision. That's there, and there's no question that it has a, you know, very strong mystical element to it. I got interested in her because she's charismatic too, and she was a part of the movement, and healing is a part of, you know, one of the spiritual gifts, that kind of healing. And there's no question but that mysticism, this kind of mystical intuitive knowledge, can lead to something like concern for healing. It isn't just a matter of having the experience. But a lot of the critics of mysticism say, well, what happens now that you've got this insight? What are you going to do with it? Are you just going to sit there and, you know, admire it, you know, and put it up there on a pedestal, and everybody walk around and say ooh and ah about it? Like you get, you know, as Walter Rauschenbusch said when he went to seminary, they tipped, a marvelous expression, he said, they tiptoed from one absolute to the next. And here was one great idea, and they stood around, somebody dusted it off, and they went ooh and ah, you know. And here, you know, was another great idea up on a pillar or something, and everybody ooh, and you know. And mysticism obviously has to lead to something, and I think with something like spiritual healing, there's no question that this would be a tremendous sense tremendous benefit, because in many people in the mystical tradition talk about a sense of unity and well-being again, which they didn't know before, and a greater sense of understanding why something like, let's say, pain or mental suffering or something, you know, has happened to them. And that they can be told all the things by the right counselors about why they have pain or why they have suffering and all the rest, and somehow that just doesn't satisfy them. They can be told all the, you know, the explanations, and still they feel there must be something more to it.
I'd like to question the same. You said mysticism obviously has to lead to something, and that just appreciation of these absolutes or whatever.
Well, I think it does something to you. It gives you a greater sense of well-being. All I'm saying is I don't mean it should be just strictly an academic exercise. I mean, I can sit and study Plato and just look at Plato, and I can, you know, write out a blue book and an answer for Howard Hong, and, you know, this is what Plato says. And that's all that has happened, is that I've learned a lot of things, and I put a lot of things, you know, together in a meaningful cause and effect way, and nothing has really changed in my life because of my understanding of Plato. But that's what I mean by mysticism. A mystical experience should give you a greater sense of understanding, not just one more interesting thing to learn.
Yeah, so it's a sense of well-being. But were you also implying that because of that, the person is going to go out and do something? Or
not necessarily. This is where some of the critic, I've got a long criticism here by Peter Marin on it, that he thinks that it's much too individualistic inward, and that you have to get out and meet the world where it really is. That's one of the chief criticisms on this. And I wouldn't want to make any ground rules. I think every person has their own needs, and, you know, like Martin Luther was certainly an activist, but he had that marvelous statement, the busier I am, the more I pray. If I know the day is going to be very busy, I'll pray that much more, or I'll be in a sense of, in a state of meditation longer. So.
Value just in the
yes.
meditation that
yes.
value in itself, it doesn't have to necessarily lead.
No, it doesn't have to lead. Right.
Although it might,
but you can't measure that, because you can't say, now that I've studied this, therefore I did that. If I hadn't studied this, I wouldn't have done that. You can't
really measure the depth of an inner experience.
No.
Yes, but if you find peace of mind and peace, that's an end in itself. If you haven't had
if you hadn't had it before, right.
So then you don't have to go beyond that if you don't care to.
If you don't care to, wait, that's a good, I think, way of putting it, right? That if that's what you're searching for, then that's something that happens to you, and if it does take place, then you know
seems
that
like
it's taken place.
This is what many people are seeking in this day.
Right, very much. And so many of the old certainties and the old assurances are gone.
Right. That was the mystical experience of the corporate body in the context of
Yes, there I was going to say, if you want a mystical idea, it's certainly the Lutheran teaching and communion.
Well, sacraments, either one of them.
Either one, right. That can only be understood that way, because some of my Reformed friends are always after me, you know, about this business about eating bodies, he said, you know, and so on. And it's very difficult, and you can't really explain it, you know, in rationalist kinds of terms. And that's one reason I like the Reformation tradition, the Episcopalian Lutheran tradition, in which there is the element of mystery and something beyond, because so many people have simply made, well, like communion is simply a memorial service. They might as well, you know, you don't, I mean, that's just, I'm Lutheran on the sacraments. That's all I'm saying is that to me that means much more than a memorial service. But that's just my own personal bias. In seminary, I remember I got a test back, and the only, the teacher just made that comment. He said, George, did I see you're still a Lutheran, you know? And he was a Baptist, and I think he thought he had lost or something. Okay, thanks a lot.